Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
I'm Karen Given, filling in for the vacationing Bill Littlefield. Choosing a book off the Only a Game bookshelf can be a challenge. Right now there's a biography of a woman who sailed around the world in an era when women just didn't do that sort of thing, multiple copies of a history of the New York City Marathon, and no less than 5 different accounts of the New York Giants championship season. Choosing Michael Rosenberg's War as They Knew It, Woody Hayes, Bo Schembechler, and America in a Time of Unrest was easy. I'm not a fan of Ohio State or Michigan football, and I certainly didn't pick up the book because of a fascination with overly important college football coaches. But there's something irresistible about examining the coaching careers of 2 famous rivals in the context of the turbulent 60s and early 70s. I spoke with Michael Rosenberg and asked him why he decided to take on such a broad and seemingly unwieldy topic.
Well, there were certain things that I knew going in that sort of piqued my interest. I knew that Woody Hayes had visited the troops in Vietnam 4 times. I knew he was a friend of Nixon's. I knew he spoke to students on campus during a campus protest. I knew that he walked to work 3 miles rather than ride because he was worried about America's reliance on foreign oil. This seemed like a very unusual guy to me. And I knew that Ann Arbor in 1969 was not the football town that we know today. So something in there told me that maybe there was a story there to be told, and I didn't know exactly what the story was, and 3 years later, hopefully I figured that out.
You began War as They Knew It with the stories of Woody Hayes assaulting an Ohio State player in the locker room during halftime, and Bo Schembechler getting lost on his way to the field house at the University of Michigan. These are pretty humble beginnings for what's been called the greatest rivalry in college football.
Yeah, it really is, and sort of an indication that you really never do know what's coming. I mean, Woody Hayes, as you said, hit Jim Otis, who was one of his favorite players, for fumbling twice in the first half. And the reason I led with that anecdote is, throughout the course of the book, Woody kind of moves a little bit over from where he was. He was a little crazy and became a little crazier, and the country moves a little bit in the other direction, and all of a sudden, he doesn't know what his place is there. Bo Schembechler, meanwhile, comes to Ann Arbor at a time when football is not popular, when his best player on his team, Dan Dierdorf, won't wear his letter jacket on campus because he doesn't want people to know he's a football player. That's a real establishment activity. And then by the end of the decade, Bo Schembechler is literally a god. Well, maybe not literally, but figuratively a god in Ann Arbor.
You mentioned Woody Hayes visiting the troops in Vietnam, but the 2 largest influences on his life were General George S. Patton and Ralph Waldo Emerson. He was known to say that the first safety blitz was designed by English Admiral Lord Howard, who split the Spanish Armada in 1588. He called the sidelines the Alps. Did the 1960s change Woody Hayes at all?
He was really heartbroken over what he saw going around him. His feeling was the world should be like his football program, where you have everybody doing the same thing over and over again, together, exactly as they're told to do it, with no individualism. And it becomes clear over the course of this era that not only is the country kind of rejecting that model, but it's really mocking that model for society. And that really, really destroyed him. And one of the interesting conversations I had during the course of reporting the book was, I said to somebody who knew Woody well, it seems like his demise was really a year or so in the making. And the person I was talking to kind of shook his head and said, no, it was at least 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 years in the making. And that's really the story of the book.
Well, it probably was a very good thing that Hayes was coaching at Ohio State and not Michigan. Describe the campus at Ann Arbor when Bo Schembechler took the job.
One thing about the sort of the hippie culture was that it was cultural as well as political. It seemed like everybody was involved. They were literally setting off bombs in Ann Arbor. The Weathermen were a radical group that had formed off of Students for a Democratic Society. And Bill Ayers, who's obviously been in the news lately with Obama, was one of the people I interviewed, and he's a character in the book. The White Panthers was another radical group. And these people literally wanted an American revolution. And meanwhile, over at the football program, Bo Schembechler is beating up his guys. It's almost this Neanderthal thing. And the contrast there was just fascinating to me.
You mentioned earlier that Woody Hayes was a Nixon man, and Richard Nixon cared more than perhaps a president should about the Buckeyes' win-loss record. The presidential favor switched when Gerald Ford, a former center for the Wolverines, took office. How much did the involvement of 2 sitting presidents add to the importance of the Ohio State-Michigan rivalry?
Well, you know, it was really interesting to me the parallels there between Nixon and Woody Hayes. And when Nixon resigned, Woody was disappointed in him, not because of Watergate, not because of the cover-up, but because he quit. He could not stomach how anybody that he admired so much would quit. Gerald Ford was very important because Beau Schembechler was not political at all, really, until he got to know President Ford. And that's when it really started to change. And then in the second half of his career, he was probably as politically vocal as any coach in the country.
These two teams spent the entire season preparing to meet. Often Hayes and Schembechler wouldn't even talk about the next game until late in the week. Instead, they'd spend early week practices all season long prepping for the last game of the season. Did all that preparation make for good games?
They were riveting games in their own way. They were not necessarily fun to watch. You kind of had to know the backstory because I did watch all of these games on very fuzzy DVDs in preparation for this book. And it's just guys running into each other. I mean, there was not a lot of passing. Even Beau acknowledged to me when I sat down with him a few years ago, he said, the game is more popular now than it used to be. But he appreciates what that was like because he knew what went into it. Literally every limb on every player had to be doing exactly what it was supposed to be doing for that play to work.
Their teams might have been rivals, but Woody Hayes and Beau Schembechler were friends. And not just that kind of pretend friend that rivals often are. These two men genuinely liked and respected each other. My favorite account of that friendship comes in 1977 when Michigan beat Ohio State for the second year in a row and ruined Hayes' hopes for a national championship. I'd like you to read a little bit of that passage for me.
For the game, Ohio State would outgain Michigan 352-196, but the Wolverines had won 14-6. Schembechler found Hayes in the tunnel and tried to speak to his old coach, but in the pandemonium, Hayes didn't hear him. When the two men crossed paths again later, Schembechler attempted to explain himself. I tried to say hello to you, Schembechler said, and you didn't know it was me. Hayes looked at Schembechler. No, no, Hayes corrected. You didn't know it was I.
Was Schembechler at all upset that his mentor had corrected his grammar instead of congratulating him?
You know, I don't think so. I think he just figured that was Woody. And one thing about both of these coaches was when they were your coach, they were kind of your coach for life. And because Woody was Beau's coach at Miami of Ohio, I think Beau always saw Woody as his coach for life, even during these 10 years when they were facing off in this rivalry.
And later, when Hayes left in disgrace, I mean, Schembechler was sad for him, yes?
He was heartbroken, and I think he didn't actually see the event coming, but he saw it coming that this was not going to end well for Woody. And he knew at that moment that the critics had won, that their version of who Woody Hayes was would be the version that would be told for generations. And it really crushed him, and he went down to talk to Woody to try to get him to apologize. And Woody did apologize, but he didn't go far enough for a lot of people, and Beau's fear came true that I think in the last three decades, Woody Hayes has been known more as sort of the craziest football coach that ever lived than for all the wonderful things he did for so many players.
Well, I mean, that craziness has been caught on camera. That loss to Michigan in 1977 was also remembered as the year that Hayes punched an ABC cameraman on camera. It was, of course, Hayes' temper that finally lost him his job after he punched an opposing player who dared to intercept an Ohio State pass, again on live TV, this time during the Gator Bowl. How was Hayes able to get away with so much for so long?
Well, winning football games is very, very important in Columbus, Ohio, and he won a lot, and the people there really knew all of the great things he did beyond football. They knew about all the hospital visits. They knew how much he treated sick kids. They knew that he had turned down pay raises. They knew that he got upset when players would go play pro football because he wanted them to go to law school instead. He felt that they were wasting their lives playing pro football. So they knew that about him, but what would happen is over time, people at the university really became tired of being seen through this prism of Woody Hayes. They didn't like it, and it just grew and grew and grew, and Woody didn't quite realize how many people were like that, that were feeling that way. And by the end, he was one incident away, and if you're going to be one incident away from losing your job, probably striking an opposing player on national television is going to get the job done.
Hayes and Schembechler had enormous success in the Big Ten. They had multiple undefeated regular seasons against very good teams. But both Hayes and Schembechler were slow to adopt the passing game and had terrible showings in bowl games. Given that they couldn't find success on the national stage, can they still be considered two of the best coaches in college football?
Yes, I think so. In fact, I think that they're two, probably the top 15 or so coaches in the history of the game, I think, by most standards. I mean, to win as many games as they did and to do as well as they did over that kind of period of time is really extraordinary. But there's no doubt that part of their legacy, especially in those years, was not winning those bowl games. And their teams could not pass. And more than that, I think they could not defend the pass. They hadn't done it all year. And they would go out into California for the Rose Bowl, and they'd be playing on grass instead of artificial turf. And they would be facing these quarterbacks and these complex passing schemes. And more often than not, they came up short.
You don't shy away from Hayes and Schembechler's faults. They were pigheaded, prone to temper tantrums, demanding, and neither of them believed that women should be athletes. But I can't shake the feeling that if I sat down to dinner with either of them, I'd probably have a good time. Is that part of the point you tried to make with this book?
Yeah, I really had a lot of empathy for these two guys. I had empathy for Bo arriving in Ann Arbor thinking he's going to coach football, and all of a sudden he sees that people are literally shutting down the campus with strikes, and he has to try to keep his players away from that and still try to run practice. And I had an empathy for Woody as someone who cared so much about his country, and not only was his game passing him by, but really the world was passing him by, and he didn't really know how to deal with it. And I could see how selfless they were in so many ways, so there's not one person in this book whose methods and politics I totally agree with, from the radicals to the administrators to the coaches. But I appreciate that with so many of them, their heart was in the right place and they were trying to do the right thing. And I did know Bo Schembechler, and I do think you would have enjoyed sitting down with him. And from what I can tell from Woody Hayes, I feel like I knew him, and I would wish I could have sat down with him myself.
To what extent are the current coaches at Michigan and at Ohio State influenced by Schembechler and Hayes?
Well, Jim Tressel, when he arrived at Ohio State, realized this was still Woody Hayes' program, and he had to embrace that. And he really has. He talks about Woody frequently. He has former captains back for breakfast for home games. So he's really embraced the tradition of the program. Rich Rodriguez, when he arrived at Michigan before this season, I don't think fully understood the legacy of Bo Schembechler and how much the traditions that had been established here since 1969 mattered. He's learning very quickly because he's taking some heat for that. And the fact of the matter is you cannot coach at Michigan or Ohio State without acknowledging, respecting, and talking about these two men, because they're still the godfathers of these programs.
Michael Rosenberg wrote War as They Knew It, Woody Hayes, Bo Schembechler, and America in a Time of Unrest, published by Grand Central. Michael, thanks for joining me.
My pleasure.
My conversation with Michael Rosenberg will be featured in this week's Only a Game, as will my cruise aboard the schooner American Eagle in the annual Gloucester Schooner Race. Joel Rose reports from New Freedom, Pennsylvania on handcar races, handcars being those human-powered contraptions that railway workers used to get from place to place when a working locomotive wasn't handy. We'll also muse on the highly successful season of the Chicago Cubs and the Angels of whatever city they're claiming to be from these days. And Charlie Pierce will be on hand to make sure I've learned everything I need to know about this week's sports news. So join us, and remember, you can always listen to the program at onlyagame.org.